There we go. There we go.
Boom.
Hey, everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood.
Welcome back to Make Me Smart. This show is all about, as you know, tech, the economy, and culture.
And, of course, talking to our guests, our listeners, because you know it, none of us is as smart as all of us.
Sometimes they're the same, actually, our guests and our listeners. I'm just saying.
That's so the best part.
That's right. We are going to do something today that, honestly, we've been working on for at least a year, maybe more. And it's a pretty basic question, and that is capitalism working fundamentally? And if it is it working for enough people?
What's kind of amazing about this is if you go back in time in our show, you will see that episode 2 is the episode where we...
Wow.
Oh, yeah. Where we raised the question of whether businesses would be a check and balance for government.
Right. Yep.
And then we did a whole... And then there was a blog post about the limits of moral capitalism. I'm not saying we invented it. I'm just saying that there are receipts. And we did a whole episode 2.5 where we explored the idea of whether moral capitalism would work for business. Then we did this 3-part run last year with guests like Arthur Brooks, president of the American Enterprise Institute, to talk about whether there was a business case for moral capitalism. Yeah. We talked about stock buybacks. We had a whole like audience call out about what we should call this, conscious or ethical or moral. And I'm not trying to take all the credit, but I think I said on this very show that I wanted to like quit my job and found the Moral Capitalism Political Party, I'm stoked to see these actual discussions with these actual words make their way into the political landscape.
So we are telling you all that and patting ourselves on the back if we can get our own arms out of the way.
So we can tell you this.
Last week, Congressman Joe Kennedy, Massachusetts, gave a speech to the New England Council that was about this thing called, that he calls, moral capitalism. And he advocates that Democrats at a national level should make that fundamentally their economic platform. Okay? So he gave this speech. The question, of course, is now what you're going to do, Congressman? So we called him up. Hey, Congressman Kai Rizdahl in Los Angeles, sir. How are you?
Hi. Hey, how are you?
I'm good. Listen, you got to get some better hold music. That's all I'm saying.
I'm embarrassed to tell you I didn't even know what it is.
Oh, my God. Well, call yourself one day. It's terrible. You'll be embarrassed.
I thought the hold music was delightful in a very throwback sort of way.
That's right. That's exactly the image we're trying to craft is a throwback sort of way.
I don't think that's actually what he's doing. The best part was he said, you know, they don't usually put me on hold, so I don't know what it is, which is his own office, which is great.
He just like dropped the mic on that one. It was super subtle and very baller.
Yes.
Once we actually started, I asked him, so what is kind of adorable, and you will hear this later, is that I think Joe Kennedy was a little startled at the amount of response
for sure
that he got from this speech. And so, you know, I asked him, look, you gave this speech, turned it into a really big deal. Have you been able to translate that into policy in the last 7 days?
Working on it. Look, I gave the speech actually early last week, right after Thanksgiving. This has been something that has been important to me, and I've been diving into over the course of the past really close to 8 months or a year or so. Informed a bit by obviously my travels around my district, but then an awful lot of my travels around the country in support of other House candidates, and felt that as I was traveling around and as things were coming together, it was finally time to try to lay it out on paper and then in a speech, but candidly didn't expect it to kind of bounce the way it did.
I'm sure I don't have to point out to you, Congressman, that David Brooks in the New York Times, also David Leonhardt this past weekend, have taken up the cause or sort of joined the cause that you are espousing here. But both of them, as do you, don't say, listen, here's how we get from where we are to where we ought to be. What are you going to do?
So I think the place to start is recognizing that government has an essential role to play here. The private sector has an essential role to play. Civil society has an essential role to play. And it is not just to rely on business to help solve these problems, that government also has to step up. And there's been a lot, I think, written and said, and I think on the one hand, deservedly so, targeting corporations that are able to scrape by on very low wages because workers are then forced to supplement their income on programs like food stamps. That being said, if the federal government just forced them to raise the minimum wage, we might not have to do that. And so it is not wholly the responsibility of companies to try to solve this problem if government isn't willing to do so itself. And that's where I think we can offer some incentives along the way to solve some of these challenges. But government should not be waiting or just solely incentivizing the corporate sector to and the private sector to solve these issues as we go along either.
Well, and it sounds like what you're talking about is a little bit of a combination of policy and philosophy. And on this show, my co-host over there likes to say that capitalism doesn't care whether you live or die.
Make me the bed, and, yeah, sure.
And I'm wondering, no, I'm just, I feel bad, actually. I feel like I stepped on his line here. But I'm wondering, as I read through your speech, you know, you really trace this moment back to the 60s and 70s when we broke the social contract, you say, when government policies moved toward protecting business at all costs. And so I guess I'm wondering, are you saying that capitalism used to care whether you lived or died, or that government used to care?
I think a government certainly put in place the policies to make sure that the benefits of capitalism were far more widespread than they are today. And so I think a government did a better job of caring for its citizens, certainly. Although, let's be clear, and as I indicated in that speech, the 50s and 60s and 70s were not exactly a time of without robust social change or social progress. But you're right. I actually pointed to this episode in the Cold War between then Vice President Nixon and Premier Khrushchev on the famous moment of the kitchen table debates about what economic system, communism or capitalism, would actually provide the greatest amount of good for the greatest amount of our citizens. And well, you might have some conservative economists at the moment that would argue that capitalism as currently structured would today. It's just emphatically and empirically not true. It's not. If trickle-down economics worked the way they thought it would, the middle class and the aspiring middle class, working class families, should be doing really well today because the rich have never been richer and corporation balance sheets have never been fatter. And they're not. And that's not just an issue in industrial towns like the ones I represent, like Fall River and Taunton, Massachusetts. You see that through an industrial Midwest. You see this across the West Coast and the East Coast and the North and the South.
Since you mentioned Vice President Nixon, Congressman, let me throw another politician.
I don't often praise him.
But it was a good example. But look, let me throw another one at you. And his name is Donald Trump. And you say in this speech, in essence, that Donald Trump picked the Democrats' pocket, that he took your economic story and ran with it. And I wonder if honestly, the Democrats have been blowing it.
Clearly, I think there's room for improvement here. But I think just as Republicans and trickle-down economics is the way to go, and again, emphatically not true and empirically not true, I think Democrats have to recognize the fact that just pure redistribution isn't going to work either. And yes, that clearly has to be a part of the story here. But we do not have the resources to pay for a $4-plus trillion infrastructure debt, a college education for everybody for free, all of the needs around healthcare, which is an important goal of mine, too, to make sure that everybody gets access.
I'm sorry. Let me just back you up on the college education thing, right? Because Bernie Sanders came within a whisker of the Democratic presidential nomination by saying everybody gets free college without a whisper of anybody talking about how to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and come on, right?
Well, sort of, right? I mean, look, if we're going to start attacking presidential candidates for being aspirational, the list is going to be long.
But that's not what I'm saying, right? I mean, come on.
No, but so I think what you are seeing there is what a college education means is a pathway to a middle-class job where people can work their lives, retire with dignity, and provide for a better future for your families. And so, yes, I think if you're what you see from, I think, an aspiring middle class and middle class across the country is a wealthier segment of our society that is getting much wealthier. Well, the economic strains of this system come down on them and saying, well, if you're telling me that I got to get a college degree to get ahead, but you're putting a $1.4 trillion debt on my back, then how are we possibly supposed to be able to not only invest in ourselves and have our own children, but pay for our parents if Medicare gets gutted? Because that's also what they want to do. So the numbers here just don't work. And if they don't work, you're going to have to give it to me for free. And what I'm saying is, there are investments, structural investments, that our government needs to make, which is why you do need to redistribute a bit. But you also have to recalibrate some of these investments to some of these the corporate investments as well to make sure workers are actually getting a better shake. That's the type of stuff I'm calling for.
In some ways, it also sounds like you're calling a little bit for re-regulation as opposed to deregulation. And This speech has resonated so much, I think, in part because clearly, as evidenced by Donald Trump's campaign, this is what everybody in America feels right now, right? This is what a huge number of people feel about our economy. And then I wonder at what point the conversation about re-regulation or whether moral capitalism is really just government doing its job as a check and balance on government, on business, will run into the partisan wood chipper.
So I think, yes, it's regulation, and obviously that has something to do with it, but it's regulation not just for regulation's sake. It's regulation to recognize that what Donald Trump did, getting back to the point made a second ago, what Donald Trump did was basically take the regulation out of the economy, try to overheat it, and then claim credit for all of these jobs and wealth that was created without ever giving any thought to it doesn't just matter how much, but who. And what I'm saying is how much is great, but who also matters. And just because you got more billionaires that get another billion isn't the same thing as creating an entire investment in a middle class, an aspiring middle class. And so regulation can certainly help with that. The fact that we are in the midst of an economy that is now seeing unemployment rate of below 4% on the backs of a tax bill that added $1.5 trillion minimum to our debt over the course of the next 10 years and has helped incentivize $1.3 trillion in stock buybacks to come back to corporations in our country. Look, that's an awful lot of money. There's a lot of shareholders that are going to do very well from that. That's great. Aside from the fact that 50% of Americans do not own a single stock, that $1.3 trillion comes back to folks that can afford to have those stocks that ignores folks that can't. And that's not fair. We can put structures around that, or incentives around that, to say, for example, if you want to do some of those stock buybacks, then let's try to make sure that there's an investment in a pension plan for employees, or an end of year bonus, or a raise, or some sort of way that they are going to benefit from the wealth that they helped to create. Not the example that is a big one back here, Phillips Lighting in Fall River, Massachusetts. They had a plant in Fall River for over 40 years. They got early investments from the state, from the federal government, from the city of Fall River. The company earned over $300 million in global profits, not obviously out of that one plant, but $40 million in global profits last year. They announced about $180 million in a stock buyback and then closed that plant of 160 employees in Fall River, fired every single one of them, and moved the plant to Mexico. So you tell me the economy is going great. It's going great for that CEO. It's going great for the shareholders that are taking that $180 million in stock buyback. And it is devastating for the 160 employees that just lost their job in Fall River, Massachusetts, with median household income of $34,000 a year. And we don't have to accept that just by saying there has to be the sole goal of a CEO is to try to maximize shareholder value. That's just not true.
So let me throw another one at you, Congressman, that probably got a lot more press than Phillips Lighting, which is Mary Barra and General Motors, right before the holidays, laying off 15,000 people because closing five plants or reducing capacity because, as she said, our products simply weren't selling. Now, she runs a ginormous publicly traded company that we have to say here got a huge bailout 10 years ago to keep the automobile industrial economy working in this country. What is her obligation? Is her obligation to the company and making it profitable so that, yes, those 15,000 lose their jobs, but the other 240,000 who work for GM can keep on working? Where does her obligation lie?
Her obligation relies to both. And this is my point, is you don't have to say it's one or the other. It can be both. And look, this isn't just saying we've got public markets. We want to make sure that those companies are valuable and still respond to investment, of course. But that stock price, GM had also taken back about $10.6 billion in stock buybacks, mm-hmm. I believe, since 2015. Mm-hmm. So it's not just to say that GM hasn't done well. Their stock went up. So there's a way there to make sure that workers share in the benefit that they helped to create and that they're not just some speed bump for investors, shareholders, and a CEO to drive on over because they can make an extra buck about it. The other piece here that I think is critically important is I genuinely believe this is not just class warfare and this is not geographic warfare, right? This is a point, getting back to your question a little while ago, to the extent that, and I believe wholeheartedly, that President Trump has essentially turned economic success in this country into a zero-sum game, where he has said that in order for some segment of this society to win, somebody else has to lose, right? And has pitted a slice of the American electorate against another, and this is a battle every single day. What I'm saying is the corporate structures and the financial incentives behind so many of these industries, behind these employees, are the same, behind these businesses, are the same affect an employee, a single mom in Kentucky, the same way that it affects somebody in Boston that is struggling trying to make ends meet. That this is not a white working class versus a new immigrant family. That the same types of incentives around, and the same structures around franchises, the same structures around the misclassification of workers and the shedding of the traditional employee benefits from healthcare to a pension fund, the move to classify folks as independent contractors affects them the exact same way as it would have, regardless of where they are geographically and their job title. But the consequence of that means that if you believe that the answer to Donald Trump's zero-sum game is in fact trying to make the case and believing that the way forward for our country is making people believe that our futures are in fact linked and that a rising tide will lift all boats, we have to be willing to do the work to make that tide rise. And that's not the cheap stuff of pitting somebody against each other. That's actually recognizing the structures that have that Donald Trump is now taking advantage of to pit somebody against another.
So Joe Kennedy, properly Joe Kennedy III, congressman from Massachusetts, just south of Boston, on a speech he gave weekish ago about moral capitalism. I think it's interesting. So I have two thoughts listening back to that. First of all, GM only has about 180, 200,000 people. I don't know where I got 240. So that's one. But the other one is, look, you could make a case that he's got some momentum, right? I talked about David Brooks and I talked about David Leonhardt in the New York Times. Elizabeth Warren the other day gave a huge speech about the bill that she's going to introduce, or maybe already has, as a foundation of her presidential campaign in 2020 to get what she calls shared governance into the corporate business model to make it a law that employees have to be on company boards. Also, Bob Reich, late a commentator on Marketplace for many, many years, also very far to the left. Which gets me to the challenge, right? Because this will all be easily dismissed out of hand by those who will point at an economy saying, look, our policies are working. And what are these leftists, liberal, you know, not pinkos, but you know what I mean, right? They're going to say, it can't just be liberals who are going to decide what we're going to do. Our economy is working here under the Trump administration and deal with that. That's what I think.
That's sort of the question I was trying to get at about the partisan wood chipper.
Yeah.
But that said, there still is a reality that, you know, we can say the economy's booming, but I think there still is a reality that people don't necessarily feel that. There's also, on the momentum side, you know, there's a Gallup poll from 2018 talking about how Democratic-leaning voters are starting to have for the first time in their measurement over the past decade, a more positive image of socialism than they do of capitalism. Mm-hmm. There's all of that research that says that, you know, 80 to 90% of millennials would switch brands to a company that they thought had a better social justice argument or did better in the world. Like this is... And, you know, not for nothing, Congressman Joe Kennedy is 38 years old. He is right in the, like, he is really talking to, I think, people of that age and a little bit younger who are new voters who are coming to this economy, who can't afford houses, who have huge student loan debt, you know, all of these things, and who are saying, yeah, we're buying this. We're buying the idea that we're asking companies and brands to have a more socially responsible outlook. And we don't think that capitalism is working for enough people. And it does feel like there's a resonance there that almost that he told us, you know, candidly, he was surprised by.
I think that's totally true. And it will be very interesting to watch this over the next X period of years play out. Right. I mean, it's going to be a thing in 2020 when Elizabeth Warren runs. Joe Kennedy will certainly run for something bigger and better at some point in the not too distant future. So we'll see where this all goes.
I know. Yeah. It is really interesting. I think he accidentally stumbled across a platform, and I suspect we're going to be hearing that a lot more.
Speaking of platforms, and how's that for a segue?
Amazing.
Come on, man, right? Trained audio, radio, podcasting professional. So look, you can get us no matter the platform. We do a smart speaker thing. I'm not going to say the name of that device because people yell at us when we say it. But if you've got an Amazon Echo and you want to know more and hear more from me and Molly, all you have to do is say the name of the device and then make me smart. And then we will talk to you.
Yes, we will. And for the holiday, we will talk to you. We'll be your friend.
That's a whole different podcast. There's a premium for that.
Exactly. At a higher donation tier, we'll be your friend.
That's right.
For the holidays, we'll be explaining, and we're very excited about this, Hallmark movies,
yep.
Butterball, Christmas Tree Farms.
Yep.
I mean, no, if you would like to have a random conversation with the two of us, just ask your Amazon Echo to make you smart. Say, make me smart, and then you're in.
Quick break, then we're coming back. Make Me Smart and Marketplace are built on independent, nonprofit news.
That is right. And we believe it's our responsibility to bring reliable, objective reporting to as many people as we can to support thoughtful conversations and informed decision making. But to do that, we need your help.
Just $5 a month. That's all it takes to become a marketplace investor.
The payoff is what you hear and what you hopefully learn every time you listen. It's also knowing you're making it possible for us to reach more people in more ways.
You're helping us produce journalism that you can trust, and that makes us all smarter. See what we did there? Now's the time to do it, folks. Donate today at marketplace.org. And thanks.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. The shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more, Wondery means business.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews, and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes every Sunday wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, look, we're back. Or listen, we're back.
Woo-hoo!
I don't even know what to say. We're here. Who's going? What are we going to do now?
I actually have a question for you.
Okay.
Because I keep seeing it everywhere. And I spoiler alert, like I saw it on the Marketplace rundown. So I know it's going to be in Marketplace today. But I would really love it if you could tell me what the heck the yield curve situation is all about.
Well, that's interesting because I was going to do a very quick thing on the yield curve. So the yield curve is a graphic representation of the difference in interest rates, which is another word for yields, that the various government securities are paying right now. And government securities go from 1 month all the way out to 30 years. You can get 1 month, 3 month, 6 month, 1 year, 2 year, 5 year, 10 year, and 30-year government bonds, right? And what's happening now, and the reason I was going to talk about this, and the reason it's in the news, is that the yield curve has become what is known as inverted. Actually, technically right now, it's just flat, but it was inverted earlier this morning. And what does that mean? Well, usually, short-term interest rates are lower than long-term interest rates. That is to say, the government will have to pay less, will have to give less interest on a one-month note, that is to borrow your money from 1 month, than it will to have to borrow your money for 30 years because it is asking you to park its money there for 30 years and you can't touch it, right? So just for instance, this is a made-up number, a one-month treasury might be yielding, you know, 0.5%, and a 30-year treasury might be yielding 3.2%, right? Because the government has to pay you for the use of your money. What's happening now is that some of those spreads, so when I say spreads, that's the difference in interest rate between, say, the 2-year and the 5-year treasury note, right? Some of those spreads are doing what is known as inverting. So instead of the 2-year being a lower yield bond and the 5-year being higher, what's happening is the 2-year is higher and the 5-year is lower. Now, why does that matter? Well, it matters because interest rates are, and I say this in Marketplace all the time, if you want to know where the economy is going, look at the interest rates, look at the bond market. It matters because what this is telling us is that investors, and yes, to some degree, speculators, believe that the economy is going to slow down. And how is that being represented? It's being represented by long-term interest rates falling. What do falling interest rates mean? Falling interest rates generally are correlated to a cooling economy. So when an economy is doing really well, as the Fed has been telling us the past 3-4 years, we're going to raise rates and we're going to make money more expensive. The bond market is saying, oh, no, 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 no. We think in the out years, actually, the Fed's going to have to lower interest rates. And why does the Fed lower interest rates? The Fed lowers interest rates because an economy is cooling and they want to stimulate and generate demand. They want to make money cheaper in this economy. So, and I don't know why I'm whispering and doing this in a weird kind of voice, but anyway.
This is fair. You know what? It's working, though. Like, my mouth is hanging open. I'm mesmerized.
It's crazy complicated, right? And I want to make sure people grasp this. So, yield curve inversion does not mean a recession's coming. If you see a headline saying, the yield curve is inverted, the recession starts tomorrow, that's not what's happening. What's happening is that the bond market is saying, okay, wait a second. There are enough troubling signs in this economy, whether it's the trade war and the China thing, which is clearly not solved no matter what the president and his advisors say, whether it's housing slung, as we've been talking about on Marketplace for a while, whether it's consumer confidence, whether it's anything. There are signs the economy is slowing. And so the bond market is saying, you know what? We believe interest rates are actually going to fall in the long term. So longer denominated yields, longer denominated bonds, rather, have falling yields. And so that's an inverted yield curve.
Huh.
God, I hope that made sense.
Yeah, it did.
All right.
Thank you. Okay. That was awesome. I like the whispery sing-songy thing. I was totally like, I'm really following this closely, like when your teacher talks quietly and you really work hard to listen.
That's right.
All of that gets to actually my obsession. I was having this argument with a friend this morning over text, which is basically like, I feel, you know, I turn on CNBC, mm-hmm. I look at Bloomberg Markets, I mm-hmm. see that you know, the stock market's down again today and there's a fear of this and apparently yesterday... You know, it's hard being on the West Coast because you're still on your first cup of coffee and you're like, wait, our sentiment totally turned from yesterday?
Yesterday,
we were all good. But I got a request. I can't do it because I'm doing this podcast now, but I got a request to be on CNBC to talk about Apple and its outlook being cut.
And their marketing, doing discounts and all this stuff, right?
Right.
I think
exactly.
That's interesting.
I think it's super interesting. And I think it goes to what I'm also feeling about this broader economic story, which is that increasingly I feel as though we are trying to talk ourselves into a recession because we think one is supposed to happen.
Well, yeah, let me channel my inner Janet Yellen and point out that economic expansions do not die of old age, right? I mean, Yellen used to get this question all the time. Here we are, Madam Chair, in the eighth year of this expansion, when's it going to end? And she would say, look, the data is good. The data is fine. And economic expansions don't end of old age. And that is still the case. So look, I take your point about trying to talk us into a recession, but we would be silly not to look at some of the data and say, this is interesting. Home sales are slowing.
Sure.
And this trade war, well, it's a real thing. And layoffs are happening all over the place. Hello, General Motors and Starbucks and Thomson Reuters.
But then we could say we could just take some sort of measured normal steps and deal with them instead of like having a 24-hour news freak out about it.
Oh, well, that's a whole different deal, right? The 24-hour news freak out is exogenous to what's happening in the economy, right? The economy is doing its own
thing. It is.
Yeah.
It is exogenous until the moment that it becomes the economy.
Well, so you know what's funny is Toll Brothers, either late last night or today, when they came out and said, you know, demand for our product, they're luxury home builders. They said demand is falling for luxury homes and we blame the media. And you know, you can't see me now, but I'm holding up a digit and it's not either one of the four polite ones.
Is it a double barrel?
No, just one. I don't do double. And I also can't do that thing where you only bend your fingers and then show them. It's a full fist with the upraised, but that's neither here nor there. Yeah, you know, so look, I get it. I understand that. But there are some things that are just happening because they're happening.
Well, there are. But here's the thing I'm going to say about Apple.
All right.
Just as one very concrete example, Apple has 13% of the global market share of smartphones.
Yes.
Which could be interpreted as a lot of growth opportunity.
Yep.
Apple has a ton of cash, like cash money, more than what a lot of companies are even valued at. It's trading at just under 15 times earnings. It has products that people love. It is a brand that every millennial can identify compared to many other brands that we thought were just, you know, known household names. It has good management. It controls its own supply chain. Like there are so many fundamentals about Apple that are pretty strong that could also consciously and calmly acknowledge the fact that a lot of people have smartphones now and spending $1,400 on a new one isn't that necessary. But instead, it's like, nope, just don't buy it. They're done.
I don't know.
It's a middle. It becomes like a middle ground thing. I'm just looking for a middle ground.
Yep. No, I get that. Tangential, but kind of not tangential. And I think we probably got to move on because really.
Probably.
So Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, has the number is like $250 billion in cash, right?
Yep.
Plus or minus?
Something like that.
What you doing with all that cash, Tim? I bet Congressman Joe Kennedy would like to have a chat. Just saying.
Well, just saying. I'm sure he would have loved to have a chat about how that $200 billion was parked overseas until yesterday.
Yeah.
And then came home and fueled a buyback. Yes, it did.
Yep.
Yes, it did.
Yeah.
Time for your comments.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
Once again, my favorite part of that sting. All right. Lots of discussion threads in our Facebook group, which is once again, Make Me Smart podcast on Facebook, about the housing episode that we did last week with housing correspondent extraordinaire Amy Scott. Chris Totten said he doesn't know if the notion of homes as an investment translates to today, really. Here's what he says. In my grandparents' time, they bought a house, raised a family, and after 30 or 40 years, sold the house and enjoyed the proceeds. But today, if we're all moving up, flipping, changing homes every few years, that original model breaks and we end up with competing goals of investment and affordability, which is totally, totally true. Look, that's what my parents did, right? They were in that house for 35 years, sold it, and literally my mom's living on that today. It's true.
Yeah. Totally my true. Friend and financial advisor is very fond of saying that one of the biggest mistakes the American economy ever did was start to see housing as an investment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Period. Yeah. You know, granted, we live in the Bay Area, so it's also not going to be. Not going to be. Evan Bartow from Sydney, Ohio, also wrote to us on Facebook. He said when buying his first home, he realized how each party, the servicer, the lender, the agent, the broker, benefited in his purchase of a more expensive home. Which made him think about how people can learn to navigate this process. He recorded his post so we could listen to it here.
I wonder where the state-funded financial education is during our formative years. Including personal finance could level the playing field as people traverse the minefield of buying versus renting. I know we are far from a free market, but it's when the consumers are disadvantaged like it is today that we get an increase in foreclosures. In the short run, this discrepancy seems to drive business, but decades from now, we will feel issues of this market as buyers approach retirement age. My experience showed me that we should provide advocates for consumers because so many are handing over thousands of extra dollars.
Yeah, I think that's totally true. A couple of very quick thoughts. Thousands of extra dollars, while it sounds like a lot in regular terms, when you're spending $300,000 for a house, it's really not that huge a percentage. And before you paint me as a cold, heartless bastard, look, I get it. Thousands of dollars is thousands of dollars. Number two. It is, right? I mean, look, I get it, but it's it's wrapped up in this larger thing that you're doing, which gets me to this. Most people in this economy, if they buy a house, and only 65% of this economy are homeowners, if they buy a house, they do it once. And so the question is, what's the ROI? What's the return on investment on setting up an educational program for that? God, I'm really sounding like a terrible, terrible person here. For a fraction of the population who has this transaction one time in their lives. So don't add.
Do they really only have it one time in their lives?
How many houses are you going to buy, Molly?
So, once, I mean, I bought one and once, I think I'm done.
And you're done, right? I'm on my second.
Well,
and
no,
I'm done.
I'm not done because now I'm a renter. So I'm eventually going to have to buy something somewhere just for when the zombies come. But no, it's just basic financial literacy is what it really is. And that is, I'm told, a goal of our show. But I will never forget sitting down to get a mortgage, you know, to evaluate what I could afford with my then husband and being told like, oh, you can afford this amount. It's only 30% of your income. It was of our gross income.
Yeah.
I mean, they literally tried to sell us a house with a monthly, you know, said like, you can afford this monthly payment that is as much as your net paycheck. But people don't do that math. They go in and they sit down and they, you know, it's like you can, or interest rates and what that's going to mean and how compound interest works. I mean, people sincerely, I think what you're really arguing for is basic financial literacy and then ignoring people generally who are trying to sell you stuff. Because,
as a rule,
they want you to buy more than you can afford. Yeah. Yep.
Kyle Byers wrote us on Facebook. He lives probably not too far from Molly in the Bay Area, works in big tech.
Oh,
And he wrote, here you go. Everybody my age, late 20s, early 30s around here, is hoping the housing market will crash. though even then, they're not confident they'll be able to enter the market because investors will likely swoop in and purchase the already limited supply, and or affordability will still be out of reach given rising interest rates. All of that is true.
All of that is true. And that's why some of this conversation, that's why I'm so fixated, by the way, on us talking ourselves into a recession, because it's like, wait a second, people's individual Americans' recovery is still fragile. Wages are barely starting to creep up, you know, and then every time, and then if you talk yourself into a recession, it's just going to hurt us all over again. Mm-hmm. Like businesses had this wonderful boom and got to buy back all their stock, got a bunch of money and whatever, and rich people got richer and whatever, and now we're just going to get screwed all over again.
So, and let's bring it back to Joe Kennedy, right? Because what's going on here, and this goes to Bob Reich in his book 2 or 3 years ago, which we had him on Marketplace, and I think it was something like Capitalism is Broken or How to Fix Capitalism, whatever. Interesting book. But Reich points out, and he's not the only one, and many others have since, that this idea of income inequality in this country could be the defining economic issue of our day if we don't get our stuff together. Because
totally.
Yeah, because people get angry, they get fed up, and then our political system is not built to respond, or it responds as it did in 2016. Anywho.
Let's make me smart question, shall we? What is something you thought you knew that you later found out you were wrong about? Kate McNeil from Jackson, Mississippi sent us this one, and we, Kai and I, are in it.
All right.
What I thought I once knew was that Kai was my absolute favorite radio host ever. He explains all the economy things, does great interviews, and loves the trade wars even more than I do.
Wow.
However, I've since learned that Molly is in fact my favorite radio host. Molly's in Oakland. I used to live in Oakland. She's into sci-fi. So am I. She's in tech. I'm in tech. Plus, there's the whole Twitter score thing where Molly got a 24 on fun and Kai got a 1. But Molly, don't rest on your laurels. I'm starting to think that the ultimate winner will be Dark Kai. Because, well, Dark Kai is all of us on some days. So next time y'all are in Mississippi, look me up. We'll go for a locally made beer or a locally made bourbon. But never, ever will we go for a pumpkin spice latte.
No, Kate McNeil, we never, never will go for a pumpkin spice latte. That was pretty nice.
That was really sweet. It's okay. You can love us both equally like children.
Yes. Yes, yes.
Hashtag one fun Kai. Well, never. That's never going to not be my favorite. Okay, not to go back to how we totally predicted this whole moral capitalism uprising thing, but we are going to put our clairvoyance to the test once again. Our predictions episode is coming back in 2 weeks. We will have some of our favorite guests on from the past year to tell us their predictions for 2019 on the economy, the Me Too movement, big tech. So get ready for that. And if you have predictions, please share them. That email, once again, makemesmart@marketplace.org, or record it as a voice memo and send that to you.
Yeah, that's better, because really nobody wants to hear us talk so much. Two more episodes left in this year. Hard to believe, perhaps, but it is true. Two more. So answers to the Make Me Smart question, your predictions, take your pick. Email us, makemesmart@marketplace.org, or join the Facebook group. Tell us there. It's Make Me Smart Podcast on Facebook, and it'll come right up when you search.
Even if we get in a bummer mood, this music always cheers me up. I'm not in a bummer mood, actually. I'm excited about the future. Me Smart is produced by Shara Morris. Senior producer is Eve Tro, because I have 24 fun and it keeps me energized. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. This week's program was engineered by Charlton Thorpe. I'm 24 fun. Oh my God, that's a good band name. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez.
The executive director of It Is a Girl, by the way. Daniel emailed me and Molly this weekend. He listens all the way to the end. And if you stuck around last weekend, you know there was some debate over what his third child was. It was a girl. The executive director of On Demand is Tar Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.